everybody.
Good morning, gang.
Here comes the special effect. Everybody get ready for it.
The Mugwife.
Mugwife.
Sounds like a phrase out of Harry Potter. Oh, yes, I got a mug wipe last night.
Time to start turning that down a little bit and getting us ready to go this morning, because we've got some serious conversations to have.
No kidding, because we're never serious on this show. It'll be a change for us. So, good morning, everybody. We have a special guest with us this week, Margie Meacham. I apologize on that mangling. It's early, and not as early as it is for you guys, but it's still early for me and my brain and my mouth. Maybe we'll get Margie to introduce herself and share a little bit of her history, how she comes to be doing what she's doing and talking with us today.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Some of you may know me. Some people call me the brain lady. And what I do is I help apply neuroscience and AI, and maybe we'll talk about how those two work together, to enhance learning. Because once we know how the brain works, suddenly all kinds of things open up for us as instructional designers. And I'm out in Phoenix, Arizona, not exactly with Brent, but we're in the same...
We're in the same...
got my coffee.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Brain-based stuff. Stuff. Isn't that a highly technical term? I think we've all agreed that stuff is the way to describe such things. Anyway, and we were chatting a little bit before we popped the go live button. And I mean, you pointed out something that actually didn't occur to me really. It was that there's actually some measure of, and I'm going to use the word delicately, controversy or perhaps not a full embracement of some of these things. So maybe you could help us understand that a little bit.
I call it healthy skepticism, and I think it's because, and I think with good reason. So there's been a lot of excitement, and you guys are probably familiar with the Gartner hype cycle, that new technology, new discovery comes up, and it's way up here, and oh, everyone's so excited, it's going to save the world. And then people begin to poke at it and realize that, and maybe it's not quite ready for prime time. It kind of happened with self-driving cars when some tragic accidents happened. And now it's, it might actually be a decade or more before these things are really safe and ready and predictable, even though their record is far better than humans. But, you know, be that as it may. And so then it plunges. And what happened with neuroscience is people realized they could make money off it. And that's the honest truth. And so there's a lot of people out there who packaged, oversimplified applications, brain training games, expensive courses that are going to teach you how to train your brain. And that unfortunately colored things for a lot of folks and made the professionals, we instructional designers, step back a little and say, oh, well, you know, I don't have time to research this myself. I guess I'd be better to err on the side of caution. Another thing to think about is the science. And it is, I mean, it's well-established science that studies the physical things that go on in your brain. And it's really many sciences. It's quantum physics. It's electric. What would be the science for electricity? I guess that's part of physics. Biology, chemistry. APA, the Association of Psychology Professionals, has completely embraced neuroscience and now is looking for physical explanations for the psychological syndromes and illnesses that they've been studying and treating. And very often the studies that I cite are coming out of APA journals. So the controversy is only out in the general public. It's not with scientists. They got no controversy about it. It's good, hard science. And like any science, it has to stand up to the test. So individual studies come out, people try to replicate them. When they can replicate them, they're validated, and that's good, sound science. The challenge is that people are often reading things in blogs, in just general news, and it tends to get oversimplified by accident, and it tends to get overemphasized on purpose because somebody's pushing something. And so you have to be very careful. So early on, one of the things I started doing was sifting through that for people. And I believe that's something that I do really well. I'm comfortable with one foot in that very techie science. People who know me know I'm kind of a geek. You know, you start talking about something really technical, that gets me excited. And that's what I do for my clients anyway, because I tend to specialize in that area. But I can also translate it and think about, now, is this something we can use? If we can use it as instructional designers drinking coffee, then, you know, then I write about it, then I put together workshops on it. There's plenty we can use, but you've got to be based in evidence on it and have a bit of healthy skepticism. And I think that's good. That's good for us as an industry. So you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You look and see what's valid. And there are plenty of things that are valid and useful today. So that's what I tell folks.
Very cool. So some of those things that are, you know, valid and useful, because I suspect that some of these things also that both studies and that sort of thing have revealed probably also kind of work maybe sometimes or compete with things that we've made assumptions about in our own industry for a long time too.
Yeah. A couple of things that I think surprise people that have actually been validated is the fact that neuroscience does more validating than anything. Is that a lot of what we've learned, because we learned it from another very valid science, psychology. Psychology is an observational science. It watches people's behavior and draws conclusions about why they do what they do. And a lot of very sound work was done in how people learn, even back as early as the 1800s. That is still valid, but now we know even more about it because we understand the physical nature behind it. And so one of those things is, for example, the forgetting curve, which was discovered by a guy who's really kind of a math genius in the 1800s, Ebbinghaus, used himself as a guinea pig. He did all his experiments on himself. I wouldn't recommend it. And he found out that
he was a Tim Ferriss of his day.
Yeah, don't do that at home. There's a very steep curve. After you've learned something, you start forgetting it immediately, a lot of it, very rapidly, unless it's reinforced. So that led him to discover the spacing effect, the learning curve, and a couple of other things that we still use today. We often don't credit him anymore. They've become such common use. Those all came from Ebbinghaus. He was kind of the Einstein of instructional design. And those have all been validated. Now we can test that inside a living brain, which was something psychology, you know, was always hindered with. So those are a couple of things that we know we can use. Now, a couple of things have been discredited, and they're widely known, and yet they still slip in at times. One of the biggest is this whole idea of learning styles, and that we should teach to the learning style that is preferred for our audience. So that means creating individual versions, you know, separate versions for every one of these learning styles. And depending on how you do it, there might be five or six of them. Well, there are learning styles. There are preferences we have. Just like some people are left-handed and some are right-handed, which by the way, happens to have a basis in the brain. There's a physical, we can look at your brain and tell if you're left or right-handed. But the problem is, somebody decided that, hey, I can make an instrument that measures people's preference. I can sell it to teachers and trainers, and then that will tell them how they need to teach to that individual, or I can sell it to individuals. The problem is, if you teach to someone's preferred learning style, another thing we know about the brain is it follows the path of least resistance. We've evolved that way. It's a very efficient way for this huge meat machine that is the most complex calculating, processing, memory device we know in the world, with over 100 million neurons and 30,000 connections per neuron and 13 different wavelengths they can communicate on. When you multiply those three numbers together, it's, you know, my math is not that good. I don't know what that number is. But what we know is that the brain will take the path of least resistance. So the absolute worst thing to do would be to make it easy. That's why learning styles does not make sense to help people. To use it as a technique and try to focus people and funnel information only the way they prefer it is doing them a great disservice. Now, another thing we know from neuroscience is information comes in from all your senses through different neural pathways. And so the more senses you get involved, and typically these learning styles are more or less connected to your senses, auditory, visual, kinesthetic. And so I want to use not just one learning style, I want to use as many pathways as possible so that I encode the same information in multiple ways, make it easier to apply, easier to retrieve later. And for all those reasons, the last thing on earth you want to do is teach to learning styles. Now, as I say, it's been well documented, but it still keeps coming up partly because there's a lot of people making a lot of money selling these programs, these systems, these assessments. And that's something we're always going to have to battle in this whole neuroscience debate.
I think what complicates it a little bit more even too is that...
And actually, yeah. I'm sorry, I just wanted... You're right, Jack, when it is stated correctly, they are preferences. And I think I've used that word a couple of times. And so the preferences do not mean that that's how we should design. You know, we shouldn't right. just hand it over to them just because they prefer it. Sorry, Brett, go ahead.
No, it's fine. And I was just going to say, I think the thing that complicates all of this a little bit is that a lot of that original data, right, that the original context of a lot of that science was applied to schools and to kids. And I think mm-hmm. being a dad, Chris is a dad too. And when you watch kids, you know, a lot of what they're learning and how they're learning obviously isn't different from adults. But when you get into the workplace and you're having to deal with helping somebody learn and to perform better, it is a little bit different in how you approach it than kids in our current classroom system or teaching them, you know, they're learning the basics of life or whatever, you know. And I think, and I don't want to oversimplify it because, it just always strikes me that we can apply all of this stuff, but we apply it differently than we do. When we apply it differently to kids than we do to adults, right? Because there's so much, and the key, I think, is the prior knowledge, right? As adults, we come to the table, we come to the learning table with a whole history, and everybody has a unique long history of prior knowledge, and that kind of changes the game a little bit than when you're dealing with brain of a child that doesn't have a lot to go on.
You know, and yet, by the time they're 6 or 7 and they're in school, there's an awful lot they do have. There's a lot of prior experience they do have. Kids already are evaluating the world before they can even talk. You know, they're learning all the time. And they learn in the womb to some extent, or at least their brain forms, while they're in the womb. I don't want to get down that path and now somebody's wanting to, you know, play Beethoven to their baby to make him a musical prodigy. That's
not that might happen. Be one of those products you were talking about.
That's not going to happen. But it's the word I think you said was it's a matter of how we apply it. I mean, it saying that a child's brain is different than an adult's brain is very true, but it's kind of like saying their heart's different.
I guess I don't really mean that in that it's different because, like I said, maybe this is a bad path for us to be marching down because there's a whole lot of...
And I agree with Lightbulb Joe. What I was getting to is that we do ourselves a disservice thinking too much, the andragogy, pedagogy argument that you teach the children differently. The truth is the K-12 teachers, they understand brain-based learning perhaps better than many corporate trainers. And if you really want to see some creative ways to help people learn, you should make friends with a teacher. So we sometimes eliminate things. We go, that won't work. And, you know, with my senior executives, they would never play that game. No, the brain likes games. You might, again, emphasize it differently. you might structure it a little differently to relate to their prior experience, but it's still going to be the same process. It's going to be the same technique.
Well, I think that's what I'm getting at is that as adults, people choose themselves away from and out of the effective learning environments and the effective learning paths because it's perceived as, I mean, it's a cultural thing, right? It's perceived as that's not what an adult does, right? Like if we know that games are incredibly powerful or game mechanics and all of that are incredibly powerful learning tools for people of all ages, it's still to walk into an executive boardroom where there's a lot of politics and a lot of adulting going on and to say, we're going to play a game because it's going to make you all smarter, they will laugh you out of the room. And so I think that's kind of the subtleties I'm getting at in our profession and in the things that we do that we have to, it's not that any of it is not that the science is bad, and I would never debunk it because I'm a firm believer in the science and especially the new neuroscience of what we know about the brain, but in how we apply it to adults that have all of these other issues and the control issues and the culture and in a corporate setting, I think that's where the subtlety lies because we can't be effective if they laugh you out of the room and say, well, you're crazy, get out of here.
Well, and as professionals, we know our audience. Now, I've been watching the chat, and Kara and Lightbulb Joe were right. And hi, ladies. Nice to see you. That all learning is brain-based. So in a way, isn't it redundant? I actually, in my work, just tend to use the term brain-aware a lot.
Well, because I like that.
It's, of course, it's understood there. And, you know, oh, thank God I did, Karen.
I think it's the branding of brain-based. I think that kind of started to get overused a lot, too. And a lot of people, a lot of contrarians in our industry started stepping up to the plate and saying they didn't appreciate the idea of brain-based. And I think it's just a term. And I like that. I like that idea of brain-aware.
You know, it's the term ATD uses. It is, in fact, the name they gave to the workshop I teach for them. So I don't think it's necessarily a term we have to stop using in the industry. But yeah, I mean, it might be kind of stating the obvious. I mean, brain-based psychology, right? Psychology is very much about the brain.
Chris, how are your brain working over there?
My brain is working. Well, I'm half distracted by the chat. So that's maybe another brain thing is the myth of multitasking that we could end up going down at some point in time too. But you know what? So just to circle back on a couple of things. I think partly our responsibility is framing how we use knowledgeable things that may not work, that may not elicit positive or immediate recognizable positive reactions. So if you want to, you know, if game or something like that is a way that you're going to bring forward some level of instruction, we're responsible for framing that in a way that management or whoever, you know, will accept or understand or see the benefits of it. So, you know, that's kind of our marketing role, you know, in a sense, with it translating things of value into ways that people can recognize those value. That's our part of our job, I think, as instructional designers and trainers. That was sort of the major thought that's been floating in my brain for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, we've got an interesting conversation about cultural differences, and you know how you pronounce someone's name has a very powerful effect on them. That's why I always try really hard to get people's names the way they want them. The way they see themselves. And as parents, you should give your kids the freedom to, you know, pick their nickname. And, you know, I know they kind of evolve in a family. It's always been something very important to me that my name is Margie. I'm often called Marge and Marjorie and Maggie and, you know, and I'll answer to all of them. But I feel like anyone paying attention knows I call myself Margie. And if I call myself that, that's probably what you ought to call me.
We can stick to it. And let's get to some of the easy stuff, because my brain's starting to explode a little bit here. So if we were to think about this and to apply some of this neuroscience in a few ways, what are some of the easy hitting ones when you're giving presentations and you're coaching and you got in talking to your clients? What are the things that you see resonating with them that are the easy wins that you might use maybe to build a little bit of trust with them and to get them hooked on the idea?
Well, there's a phrase in neuroscience that neurons that fire together, wire together. And what that means is that as those cells repeatedly connect together, they create a neural chain, and it can be made of thousands of neurons, that represents a memory. A small bit of a performance coaching that we want them to do, or a piece of information they need to remember. But the point is, it's about repetition. It's about repetition to cement that connection. And over time, the more times you go over it, those neurons recruit nearby neurons, and you make that connection quicker. Most training does not repeat, give the learner enough opportunities to repeat often enough to really take advantage of that fact and to build up the learning. And that's true whatever age you are. So we need to look at building in more practice activities, more revisiting back of things we learned earlier. So that would be one thing that is very clear in the evidence. The other thing I would tell all of us to remember as instructional designers is the learning doesn't take place until there's been the opportunity for reflection. And that's proven not just in the physical study of what happens in the brain. We've known that through empirical observational studies, you know, for quite a long time. And yet today's rapid pace doesn't give us much time for reflection. So reflection is extremely powerful. Giving people 5 minutes at the end of a lesson to say, now write down what does this mean to you. And those of you who are the people who were quoting Knowles earlier will probably recognize constructivist theory in there. Very valid, entirely validated by neuroscience.
Originally, all of that, what we called science before, the behavioral sciences, I guess we still call it that, but that was done decades prior, that now the neuroscience, we're able to look in the brain with all of that neuroscience stuff and to be able to say, aha, this is why we've observed that, this is why it works, and this is now, we can now validate it. And I think reflection is a great example of that. And I often promote that with folks, but it's the reflection part is hard in a product world when we're productizing training and productizing learning.
True. Yes. And you know, you're measured on, did you finish it?
Uh-huh.
And so that the reinforcement, the reflection, the application, and then stepping back and saying, did it work the way I was supposed to? Have I really learned? Did I, you know, and what am I still struggling with? That's not built in to the way corporate training works. And yet, it needs to be as useful, as effective as possible. So you have to fight against that. And that's where I think having some data, you know, to demonstrate here's why I'm building it this way. At least I found that helps with my clients. And so I recommend those are just two simple things that they sound simple, but they require you to design in a little different way.
I think a lot of the training world works from a principle of injection. We've got this information, we're going to squish, and it's going to be injected into you. When learning is rather, instead, it's a process of absorption. In other words, you have to take something in, absorb it, mingle it with other things, and that's how knowledge and understanding, etc. But that idea of, you know, which, I mean, ties into lectures, right? Lectures are someone standing in front of you, pushing information into your brain, for instance. Yeah. So But that idea then of what it is that training actually can achieve. Oh, well, right. We trained them for their masters of this.
Yeah, and we're really talking about, yeah, that's why I made it two separate points. Repetition during training is one thing, but you're absolutely right, Michelle and others, and then reinforcement after training. So
that retrieval, I think, is a really key word there, because that's something that I remember reading about. It's like stepping away for a while and almost forcing yourself to not forget what you just learned, but to just make your mind get distracted and to go somewhere else, and then force yourself to come back and practice retrieving that knowledge somehow is, according to neuroscience, is another way of really making that stuff stick over time. But again, it takes time.
And the other thing to add to that is sleep, is the impact of sleep on learning. I think I read something like 46% of us are sleep deprived as a rule. We never get 8 hours of sleep, and 8 hours is the minimum that we should be getting as adults. Teenagers need 10. So if you don't sleep deeply and for a long enough time, your brain doesn't clear the toxins out. So you start the next day befuddled, and you're not, it's like not giving your car an oil change. And it doesn't get the chance to go back over the new information of the day and incorporate it into existing learning. So we also need to provide people that opportunity. You know, when we say instinctively, I want to sleep on it, there's a reason we say that, is because we know our brain is going to see it differently in the morning. And that's how we work. So if I were to boil it down to those three, I just wanted to get sleep in there since I was up at, 4 a.m. today. I owe myself a little bit of sleep, and I'm gonna notice it later.
Take a nap.
I think of it. That's the shampoo effect.
Yeah, and Marco, I think the key word there is you survived. And many people tell themselves that I don't need much sleep. There is a very tiny percentage of population for whom that's actually true. The odds are you aren't. But if anybody wants some more research, I see lots of people saying I'd be interested in the research. And I'm sorry, guys, I know you're saying something. But I didn't want to let Marco go thinking that just because he survived limited sleep meant that he doesn't need it. All right.
Yeah. Well, it's the shampoo effect, as I think of it. You wake up and you've been mulling something over, the next morning you're waking up and you're in the shower, and that's when it comes to you. So I think the type of shampoo that you use is also clearly involved in this reflection.
Well, for clearing out those toxins in the brain.
That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, minty. Hey, wait a minute.
New idea. Hey, you know what, Margie, you have a great book, and I would be remiss if I forgot to say, hey, show us the book that you've got.
I think it's showing backwards, right?
It's only backwards to you, by the way. So coming up forward. So you're all good. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I've got a new one coming out that is going to be on the application of artificial intelligence to learning, because, those two fields have been partnering. The AI folks are trying to build computers that work a lot more like a brain works, which is a totally new way of thinking about computers. And we are using AI's wonderful tool to analyze all this complexity faster and to discover and build models and test things. So thank you,
just to put another pitch in for you and some of the workshops that you've been doing and the work you've been doing with chatbots and working through those, is that I think I've always thought of chatbots as being a really cool way to encourage that retrieval and practice, and that, the spreading out over time, right?
It can be an always on coach. Yeah. That's one way to use it. It can be in this world of great information. It can be a search tool or a kind of a guide through your learning base. Somebody was mentioning teaching salespeople handling objections. That's a great use of a chatbot. Yeah. And it can be a simpler way to design branching e-learning scenarios than the traditional way where we have to plot out every single possible, thing that's going to happen. And we end up with 3 or 4 possibilities. And with a chatbot, you could have it branch out into many more. And they're actually talking, electronically talking. And you could use, speech if you wanted to. whether you really need to or not, you know, would depend on your budget and things. I mean, typing to a chat is something that's normal to us. We now pretty much all expect it in certain scenarios, customer service scenarios. So why not use it in learning?
Yeah. I've often wondered why we don't take advantage of some of the other tools that are out there in other industries, because just the sheer functionality of them seem to be so useful in what we do. But since they're only branded for that particular vertical, we go, oh, well, that's not a learning tool. And it's like, oh, well, yeah, actually, it kind of is.
Well, like blockchain, a lot of people in education are starting to use that to make portable credentials. So, you know, there's another example of a technology that originated elsewhere that is very useful in education.
Yep. Hey, we've got some giveaways to do today, and I don't want to forget about that. But we actually have two different types of giveaways today, everybody. So Margie has offered up a giveaway for her book, but I'm not too sure how we want to do that. We didn't get a chance to chat too much about it. But we've also got our monthly mug giveaway that we're going to do as well. So, Chris, any idea on how we want to approach this?
So let's get you to do. I've got the list of folks who are in and or registered today. So I've got that up. So if you generate a number between 1 and 17, then I will just count down the list, and that's how we'll do the book. And then we've got the Excel file for the mug. The mug is representative of our April attendances. So let's do the book.
Oh, you want me to get the number?
Yeah, you've got the magic box.
Oh, I thought you were asking me to do it. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah, or you can do it, whatever. Either way, I moved my office and I don't have Alexa up here with me, but I'll use Siri. Hey, Siri.
All right. Well, it's better to use a random number generator because I have some kind of bias.
A number between 1 and 17. She has chosen 11. Turn it up to 11.
Oh, that was close.
Anyway.
That would be Catherine Grant joining us today, who gets a copy of the book. Woohoo!
Okay, so Catherine, I need your mailing address and how you want it signed. We're talking about names earlier. I guess, guys, can she just send it right to me? Or do you?
Drop your email into the chat there if you want, and she can reach out to you, and you guys can work that out together.
Yeah, and thank you so much. Hope you enjoy it. Did I type it in there?
Yeah, sure.
Oh, it's telling me I already sent that message. It doesn't want me to send it again.
All right, now on to the mug, Brent. Let's fire up Siri. So we need a number between. Oh my gosh. All right, so I'm scrolling through the Excel file. A number between 1 and 215. Oh, just a second, Brent, before we do this, I think I've been sent an updated one.
Yes, we have.
I've just been sent an updated list, so let's download the updated list. We are current, contemporary, on the go, doing our thing. And so we'll just pop over to the downloads and say hello to my little file.
She says it's the same.
So that's saved. Now let's get the Excel to open this thing up. Okay, so we are still remaining a number between 1 and 215.
250, okay. Hey, Siri. Give me a number between 1 and 217. Did I say that right? Was 217 right?
215, but I don't think we're at too much of an odds of it being.
No, she said 201.
201. So that would be Michelle Spencer. Who was one of the, there were 215 people who joined us for the episodes unique people that joined us for the episodes in April.
And that's awesome.
Michelle is our winner for the month of April. So
she's here today, right? I think somebody said.
She is. Isn't
that? Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Awesome. Michelle, we do have your email from the Crowdcast tool, so we'll follow up and connect with you for a shipping address. Very cool.
Fantastic. Right. Yeah, congratulations, everybody, to all of our winners today. Thank you for joining us. We've also got an announcement about ATD. For those of you that are going to ATD, we should definitely give that a shout out. Margie, are you going to be there this year?
I'm trying to work it out. I don't know for sure yet. So hopefully. Yes.
Yep. So we're going to be there Wednesday morning. We're going to do a live version of Chaotic from the event. And so far, we're going to be at the bookstore. So when you've on the first couple days that you're there, Monday, Tuesday, whatnot, figure out where the bookstore is in the convention center. And we're going to do the live version of Idiotic. We're in the space that they have carved out with all of their coffee tables and whatnot. And we're going to try to bring in some buckets of coffee and some food, and we're going to give away mugs. It's going to be a super fun time. So tell all your friends, and we're going to have some special guests there too. So we're not exactly confirmed on everybody that's going to be there yet, but Carla Torgerson's going to be there with us. Megan, help me out here. My brain is freezing.
So we got Megan Torrance.
I don't know why I forget that. Dang it. Oh yes. Thank you in the chat. They got it. And Megan Torrance. And we think Carl Kopp might be there with us. So speaking of games, the master of games himself, we're going to ask and request his attendance, and we're pretty sure he's going to be there because I'm not sure if it's a secret, but he's got a new book coming out. So we are looking forward to ATD as always. It's going to be a great show. And of course, stop by our booth and hang out with us. We're going to be having a good time. Probably we'll figure out a way to have some background music playing like this. Perhaps everybody can get selfies, and we can do a little bit of mug dancing, and maybe you could win yourself a mug at the booth too. You just never know. But I think that means done here today, everybody.
Thanks so much for joining us, gang. We'll catch up with you guys next time. And keep us in mind if you're going to ATD. Thanks, we'd love everybody. To catch up with you guys. Thanks so much, Margie.
For hanging out with us today. Good to see you, Margie.